Side 6, Marl Fox by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 251. He called out again.
No use trying to hide from us, young'uns. We'll get you. Stand where you are and drop your weapons. If you do, we'll make it quick. But move a muscle, and your dying'll be long and slow.
Dan blinked his eyes hard, rubbing a paw into them to dispel the effects of the firelight. Song was already on the move. She launched the Swallow back into the stream, and then she and Dippler helped Burble into the boat. He appeared to be in considerable pain. Song pushed the craft clear of the bank.
"Burble, are you all right?"
Yes, I'm fine, Missy. Come on, we'd best get going."
But the pretty squirrel maid had other ideas.
"Listen to me, Burb. Grab that branch hanging down yonder. Hold the Swallow offshore and wait for us. But if any beast tries to get you or the boat, let go of the branch and drift off. We'll catch up with you downstream, all being well."
Song and Dippler crawled back to where Dan hid in the shadows. The stoat was still calling.
"Naughty, naughty now. You've moved. We'll have to punish you for that, my little friends."
Song grasped her leafwood stick. Dippler and Dan drew their blades.
"No use running from them. They'll only follow us. Let's do a bit of punishing of our own, mates. Remember what Saul said. They're only bullies and cowards. Split up and go three ways."
Song crawled off into the trees toward where the stoat's last call had come from. She heard the whirl of a sling close by and the whoosh of a rock hurtling off toward their former position. A voice then, whispering low. It sounded like one of the weasels.
"'Tis hard to see in this dark. Maybe they've got away."
"Nah, they'll still be there," the stoat replied,
low but confident.
"Terrified out their wits, you wait and see. You take the left, you take the right, and circle in on them. I'll go straight in. We'll have on three sides with a stream at their backs, and then for a bit of sport, eh, Cullies?"
Song hoped that her friends had heard. She stood up silently behind the broad trunk of a sycamore and held her breath. Within a hair's breadth, she sensed one of the weasels stalking by. She stepped out behind the dark shape and hit out with the greenstone-topped stick, slamming it square between the weasel's scraggy ears. He fell without a sound. Song placed her paw on his chest. He was stunned, but still alive. She hauled him into a sitting position, binding his paws behind him to the trunk of an ash with his own thonged sling. Then she undid the vermin's broad belt and gagged him with that. Dippler lived by the code of the Gwasom Shrews, who seldom took prisoners. The weasel who had gone to the right met his end at the point of the young shrew's rapier. Dan backtracked slightly, then stepped out in front of the stoat and took him completely by surprise. But the stoat was quick. He leapt to one side and began whining and pleading with the hard-eyed warrior with the deadly sword.
"'Twas not but a joke, mate. Can't yer take a joke? 'Twas just havin' a bit of fun with yous."
Dan saw the stoat's dagger coming and dodged sideways. Then he leapt forward, striking down with the blade of Martin. The stoat fell with a shriek as Song and Dippler came charging through the trees.
"Dan, are you hurt? Did you get him?"
Dan stayed the writhing stoat on the ground with his footpaw.
"I'm all right. Unfortunately, my aim was bad in the darkness, or this scum would have been dead now."
The stoat groaned, then spat viciously at Dan.
"You wounded me bad, you stupid young fool. Couldn't you see 'twas only a joke? We wasn't going to hurt yer."
Dan placed his sword edge on the side of the stoat's neck.
"One more word out of your lying mouth, and your head'll be talking to your tail. How's that for a joke, eh?"
Song nodded back into the woodland. "Knocked my vermin cold and left him gagged and bound to a tree. How did you fare, Dip?"
Dippler wiped his rapier with a pawful of grass.
"Old Gwasom proverb. A dead enemy ain't an enemy no more."
Sheathing his blade, he went to the stoat, calling aloud.
"Burb, 'tis me, Dip. You can bring her inshore now, mate."
Dan took Song to one side. "What do we do with the stoat?" he said quietly. "I couldn't bring myself to kill him, and we can't just leave him here." The squirrel maid watched the writhing, groaning beast as she sought for a solution.
"Go and get some river mud. Leave this to me."
Dan fetched a good glob of mud from the shallows. Song knelt by the stoat, who was wounded deep in his right side. She tore off a strip of his tunic, slapped the mud on his injury, and placed the torn tunic and a pad on top of it.
"There, you'll live. Tomorrow you can free your friend. He's tied to an ash back there. Listen carefully to what I'm going to tell you, stoat."
The stoat sneered and cleared his throat, as if he were about to spit at Song. She gave him a quick hard cuff to the face.
"Spit at me, and I'll leave you to my Gwasom friend. You heard his rule about enemies. From now on, you'll have to learn to live with yourself. No more bullying, stealing, or villainy for you, stoat. With that wound, you'll probably limp or walk bent for the rest of your days. My advice to you is to build yourself a home, grow your own food, or harvest it from the woodlands. Fish, do what you will, but learn to lead a quiet, honest life."
When Song arose, the stoat lay sneering at her.
"Leave me alone, squirrel. I knows how to lead me own life, see?"
Dan tugged her away from the wounded vermin.
"Leave him. Some beasts never learn. He'll be an idiot all his life, and end up a dead fool."
It was not wise to stay any longer where they had camped. The four friends paddled off downstream and chose a campsite on the opposite bank. Too weary to do anything further, they dragged the Swallow on shore, overturned the boat, and slept under it for the short remaining time until dawn. Morning brought with it another bright summer day. Eager to be off, the travelers breakfasted hastily. Soon they were paddling along in the center of the wide stream. Sitting behind Burble, the young squirrel maid could not help but notice the dark bruise at the base of his neck.
"Take a rest if you need it, Burb. We'll do the paddling."
"No need for that, thank you, Missy. I'm all right. Us river-red voles are tough as old oak trees."
"Yes, yes, that's a fact."
Dan shipped his paddle.
"No need for any of us to paddle, matey," he called back to Song. "See how fast this current's running? May as well sit back and rest. We'll only need paddles to steer around rocks and things."
By mid-morning, the green tunnel of overhanging tree branches was showing signs of thinning out. When noon arrived, they were sorry the shade had been lost, for there was little respite from the blazing sun as the Swallow shot along on the swift stream. Dry, arid scrub and rock-strewn banks, with little shrubbery growing in the dusty brown earth, stretched before them on both sides. Now they needed the paddles. The broad, deep stream grew treacherous, and sharp stone pinnacles began to appear, some with heavy drifts of timber, washed down by the water, piled up against them. On either side, the stone sides of the banks rose higher, banded umber and fawn, worn smooth by the rushing torrents. The Swallow's prow bobbed up and down as she sped between the steep walls of the gorge. There was little the travelers could do to arrest their furious progress. Dan and Dippler sat forward, plying their paddles this way and that to get the Swallow around the pinnacles, while Song consulted the rhyme Friar Butty had given her, speaking it aloud to Burble. "Then when the sky shows blue and light, and clear down to the bed you gaze, be not deceived by rainbows bright. Beware tall stones and misted haze." Song turned her eyes upward. "We're no longer in the green tunnel, so there's the sky showing blue and light. Is the water muddy or clear, Burb?"
"Ah, 'tis fast running, as you know. But still the stream's deep and clear.
Yes, yes, very clear. I see the bottom deep down."
"Great seasons. Look at the size of those rocks ahead."
They looked in the direction Dippler was pointing. Two enormous rock pinnacles, their tops thick with vegetation, reared out of the water farther downstream, like primitive sentinels. What lay beyond them was lost in a haze of mist, formed by water spray shooting high, as the stream divided three ways around the rock bases. The awesome spectacle was enhanced by a breathtakingly beautiful rainbow bridging the gorge. Suddenly Song seized her paddle, shouting out above the roaring waters,
"Bring her into the side! Find somewhere we can stop! Quickly!"
Backs bent and paddles digging deep, they fought the headlong current. Tacking and veering, drenched to the skin, the four friends battled to bring the frail vessel toward the high rock wall that formed one bank. Burble spotted a possible place.
"There! See! Yes, yes! There, where the rift is!"
Backing water madly, they checked the Swallow as she ran close to the towering cliff. All Dan could see for a moment was a wraith-like armored mouse, hovering in the mist ahead, his hollow voice blending with the roar of waters.
"The sword! Dan, my sword!"
Leaning dangerously out from the prow, Dan whipped forth the sword and thrust it instinctively into the large crack running up the rock face. Throwing his weight forward against the hilt, Dan pushed hard. The Swallow hovered for a moment, then turned in a fast circle on the dashing waters until Dan found himself facing upstream. The boat had turned completely around. Straining against the mighty pressure, Dan held her firm.
"Song, do something quick! I can't hold her much longer!"
There was a ledge overhead. Song reached it the only way she could. With a bound, she was on Burble's shoulders, thrusting herself into an upward leap. Her paws grasped the ledge, and she hauled herself upward, scrabbling to find holes in the rifted stone. She pulled and struggled until she was lying flat on the ledge, hanging over the edge. She held out her paws.
"Burble, throw me the stern rope!"
The river vole threw the rope into her waiting paws, then made the other end fast by looping it around the rear seat. Song knotted the rope around a spur in the side of the rift, while the others tossed their paddles up onto the ledge. Dippler was first up the rope. He and Song leaned over to help Burble, with Dan following in the rear. As soon as they were safe from the thundering waters, the four companions hauled the Swallow up to the rocky platform with their supplies intact. Dan sat panting, his back against the sun-warmed rocks. He patted the hilt of the sword.
"Phew! Thanks to Friar Butty's rhyme and this sword, we made it. See that haze down yonder beneath the rainbow? I'd take me oath that I saw a vision of Martin the Warrior hovering there. 'Twas he told me to shove the sword into the crack."
Song looked from the misted haze to the sword.
"I don't doubt that you did, Dan. That blade must be some powerful kind of steel to hold a boat and us four safe from those waters. I dread to think what would have happened to us if we'd been swept away between those two big rocks. I wonder what's down that way."
Dippler was setting out a makeshift meal of scones and fruit.
"Let's have a bite to eat first. Then we'll follow these ledges downstream and see where the current leads."
Burble found a flask of dandelion and burdock cordial and swigged thirstily at it, massaging the back of his neck.
"Aye, you three go off and explore a while. Yes, yes, I'll stay here and guard our gear. Me old neck's a bit sore. You didn't help matters by leaping all over me head and shoulders to get up on this ledge, missy. You certainly didn't."
Song helped the water vole to rub his neck.
"Ah, poor old Burb. Never mind, mate. You'll live. But don't doze off now. Keep an eye on everything while we're gone."
When they had finished eating, Song, Dan, and Dippler took the rope from the Swallow and set off across the rocks to explore downstream. The grandeur of the scenery was awesome. Hurtling water, towering stone and spray forever cascading through curtains of mist, over which the rainbow arched like a massive colored bridge. Traveling in single file, they made good use of the rope to span places where there were gaps in the ledges. Sometimes they rested in somber moss-strewn crevices where sunlight never reached. Other times they pawed cautiously over expanses of smooth, banded stone, almost hot to the touch. Just beyond the two big rocks that stood center stream, the mist cleared, and they halted with gasps of wonderment at the sight. It was as if they were standing at the very edge of the earth. Billowing, leaping, roaring, vast masses of water fell abruptly downward into the shrouding fog of boiling spray far below. Dippler clasped his friend's paws, eyes wide as he stared down into the hurtling chaos, his shouts almost lost in the reverberating din.
"Look at that waterfall! Wow!"
They sat on the rock edge, drenched with spray, watching the awesome majesty of the waterfall. Dan pointed to the far side, where the bank ran out a short distance underwater, forming an incredibly swift shallows. There was a great bird pacing up and down the bankside, watching the water intently.
"Great seasons! Look at the size of that feller. What sort of bird would you call him?"
Dippler had spent his life around waterways. Though he had only ever seen the species once before, it was unforgettable.
"That's a fishing eagle. 'Tis called an osprey."
The bird had a white crown of plumage, and its underparts, too, were snowy white. A mask, dark brown, almost black, stretched around its savage golden eyes, spreading back over shoulders and wings. It had a heavy hooked beak and fearsome talons. Silently, they watched it prowling the bank. It struck once, but came back without any catch. Song was puzzled.
"Aren't they supposed to fly and swoop on the fish, Dip?"
"Aye, that's what they usually do."
"Aha, look!"
The eagle struck the water again, but could not catch the fish it was chasing. It gave a shriek of temper and charged awkwardly into the water, one wing flapping to retain its balance. Dippler nodded knowingly.
"It can't fly, see? Keeps one wing close to its side. Must have been injured at some time, I reckon, Song."
The pretty young squirrel maid was full of sympathy.
"Oh, the poor bird. Imagine having big, beautiful wings and not being able to use them. Oh, it's so sad to watch him."
Dippler chuckled as he saw a brown trout leaping and squirming in the shallows as the osprey chased it.
Poor bird. What about the poor fish, Missy? Mind, though, that trout's leading the eagle a merry dance. Maybe it'll escape.
As the Gwassam Shrew spoke, the trout gave a mighty leap and made it to deep water. The osprey was almost out of its depth. Squawking angrily, it stumbled and was swept into the wild, lashing deeps. Dippler put a paw over his eyes.
Nothing we can do to save him now. That one's a goner.
Before the words had left his mouth, Song was in action. Tying the rope hastily around her waist, she slung the end to Dan.
Hang on to this. I'm going after him.
Dan grabbed the rope instinctively, shouting,
Song, no, you'll be killed.
But the young squirrel mate had already plunged into the roaring melee of waters. 24. During the night, the white ghost's eerie sighing and wailing echoed ceaselessly around the queen's bedchamber. Sylph crouched in her bed, gaunt and hollow-eyed, her voice reduced to a hoarse croak from shouting for her guards.
Oh, Sylph, come to me, Sylph.
There it was again. Sylph buried her face in a satin coverlet, knowing it was not a dream. When she ventured to peep out, all the candles had sputtered and died. Only a single lantern remained burning on the bedside table. The room had become an ill-lit cavern of shifting shadows, drafts and breezes moving the silk wall hangings like fluttering shrouds. Sylph's voice was a piteous whine.
Guards, help me! Where are my guards?
Spectral tones answered her desperate plea.
Gone, all gone.
Lontor beckoned Wilka out of the room from which he had been impersonating the white ghost.
That's enough wailing for now, Rat. There's no reason for any of the guards to be up here, since I dismissed them for the night. But just in case any beast tries to gain entrance, you stay at the head of the stairs and keep them away. Tell them the High Queen is very ill, and any creature coming up here against my orders does so under pain of death. Got it?
Wilka nodded silently and went off about her task. Lontor took up the tray she had prepared. It had two goblets upon it. One was Silt's own drinking vessel, beaten from fine gold, with her personal crest embossed on its stem. The other was a plain serviceable pewter type. Lontor made sure the queen's goblet was on the far side of the tray as she carried it into the bedchamber. Sylph cowered away from her, bunching the satin coverlet tight under her chin.
Where are my guards? How long is it until morning light?
The white ghost has been haunting me again. Did you hear it?
Well, did you? Speak, daughter.
Smiling benignly, Lontor perched upon the bed, placing the tray next to the lantern on the table. Her voice was that of a true marl fox, sweet as honey and deadly as an adder's bite. She removed the coverlet gently from Silk's chin.
Don't upset yourself, mother dear. I sent the guards away, because I don't want them clanking and tramping about outside your door when you need rest. This white ghost, 'tis all in your imagination. Sleep will cure all that. Things will look better in the light of day.
Sylt seemed to regain some of her regal composure. She chided Lontor skeptically.
Sleep? How can I sleep? You haven't the slightest idea how I suffer. I order you to stay here for the rest of the night to keep me company through the dark hours. What's this you brought, eh?
Lontor held the tray out to her mother, taking care that she presented it so the queen's cup was nearer to the royal paw.
'Tis a harmless drink, made from warm damson wine and special herbs. It will help you to sleep.
Sylph sniffed the goblet without touching it.
I don't care what it is. I'm not drinking any.
Lontor moved the tray closer to her mother.
Now don't be silly, mother. See, I filled a goblet for myself. I'm going to drink, aye, and enjoy it.
She picked up the plain pewter goblet. It was halfway to her lips when the queen rasped out,
Stop! Put that goblet back on the tray, I command you.
With a look of long-suffering hopelessness, Lontor did as she was bidden. Sylph smiled craftily at her.
You placed the two goblets on the tray so that my personal one was closest to me, as if you wanted me to drink from it.
Lontor smiled innocently back.
But of course, Majesty. 'Tis your own cup.
None but the High Queen would dare to drink from it. Sylph pushed the royal goblet across to Lontor.
Here's a better idea. You drink from my goblet, and I'll drink from yours. What do you think of that?
Lontor shrugged and picked up the golden vessel.
A wonderful idea, Majesty. I've never taken wine from a queen's cup. Mayhaps I'll get used to it.
Silth snatched the golden goblet before Lontor could taste it.
No, you won't. That's mine. Now, let me see you drain the other one. Drink.
Lontor's face blanched with fright. Her paw trembled as she picked up the pewter goblet. Silth cackled evilly.
Drink it all, you wicked young schemer, or I'll have my guards feed you to the teeth of the deeps. Drink.
Lontor was forced to swallow, her throat quivering fitfully, wine dribbling from the corners of her lips, her eyes wide with horror. Silth sipped at her own goblet, fully recovered from her former cringing self as she lectured her treacherous daughter.
Did you think you could outwit a queen of marlfoxes, my dear? I knew that you would put the poison in your own goblet. You thought I'd think it was in mine, the silly way you offered the tray so that my cup was nearest to me. I saw through your ruse, Lontor. I knew you wanted me to drink from your goblet, suspecting that mine contained the poison. So tonight you learned your last lesson. Never try to outwit a queen of marlfoxes, he-he-he.
Lontor had drained the pewter goblet. She put it aside and watched her mother, a smile suddenly beginning to play upon her lips.
There, I've drunk it all as you commanded.
Have you drunk yours yet, O High Queen? Surprised, Silth looked up questioningly.
Only a few sips, why?
Lontor removed the golden cup from her mother's paws.
One sip would have been enough. You did just as I gambled you would. Your Majesty outfoxed herself. The poison was in your cup all the time.
Queen Silth's paws dithered helplessly for a moment. Then her body flopped limply back. Lontor plumped up the pillow behind her head and folded the satin coverlet neatly under her mother's chin. The queen murmured faintly through numbed lips.
Guards, where am I?
Lontor wiped away a dribble of wine from the corner of Silth's mouth.
Hush now, your Majesty. Go to sleep, and remember your own words. Never try to outwit a queen of marlfoxes. I am Lontor, High Queen of all marlfoxes now.
Silth blinked her dimmed, watering eyes. All power of speech had left her. Without a word, she slipped silently into the deepest sleep of all. Lontor washed the golden goblet out carefully, three times. Then she filled it with new damson wine and drank a toast to herself. Morning sunlight flooded the island, as Wilka, the female water rat, wandered down to the field where the slaves were husbanding fruit and crops. Seating herself on the ground, she opened a flask of damson wine and poured two beakers. Captain Ullig, the slave master, saw her from the corner of his eye. He cracked his long whip expertly over the bent backs in front of him.
"Keep those heads down, you scum, or I'll teach you a lesson you won't forget the rest of your lives."
Satisfied that no beast would dare look up, he joined Wilka.
"Thirsty work, eh? Wish I could lay me paws on more wine that tastes like this. Well, you didn't come down here for nothing, Wilka. What news up at the castle?"
She poured more wine for Ullig, keeping her eyes fixed on the toiling slaves as she spoke.
"There'll be lots more of this wine. Much as you want, if you listen to me, slave captain."
Ullig drained his beaker and held it forth for a refill.
"Oh, aye? What is it now? Another surprise inspection from Her Majesty? Or is the noise of this whip disturbing her royal peace?"
"Oh, no. The royal peace won't be disturbed ever again, Ullig."
"What do you mean by that?"
"High Queen Silth is dead. Long live Queen Lontor and her chief advisor, Wilka."
Wine ran either side of Ullig's mouth as he slopped it down and held out his beaker for more.
"Ha-ha! I'll drink to that. So you and your marlfox friend finally finished off the old one. Clever, Wilka, clever."
Wilka's paw was like a vice as she grabbed Ullig's, restraining him from lifting the beaker to his mouth.
"Keep talking like that and you're a dead rat," she hissed viciously.
"Queen Silth was slain during the night by the White Ghost. I knew all along that White Ghost was the spirit of her mate, returning to avenge herself for the treacherous way she slew him, right?" A thin smile crossed Ullig's cruel features.
"Right you are, Wilka. Every beast knowed that someday Silth would pay for killing her mate. Lontor was his favorite daughter, so 'tis only fitting that she rules the island now, with you to guide and advise her, of course,
and me to command the army. Wilker released Ullig's paw and allowed him to drink. Well spoken, Ullig. You catch on pretty fast. Now there'll be a burying ceremony at the lakeside before long. What we need is for you to get every beast yelling, Long live High Queen Lantur! Ullig tossed the empty beaker aside and tilted the flask to his lips as he toasted the conspiracy. Long live High Queen Lantur! Wilker gathered up the two beakers. Not so loud, friend. No beast's supposed to know she's dead yet. One of the slaves, a sturdy female hedgehog, whispered to an otter working alongside her. Did you hear that? Sylph's dead, and Lantur's queen now. The otter labored on, not raising his eyes. Makes no difference to us, does it? One marl fox is bad as another to a field slave. The news would have made little difference to Mokun, either. The marl fox, following his own secret route, found himself attacked by lizards. He had deviated, by mistake, from the river into a water meadow, which, half a paddle's depth beneath the surface, was swamp. Berating the rat paddlers and the shrew Fenno, he had them turn about, only to find that the way back to the river was blocked by a teeming horde of lizards, newts, and toads. The first inkling he had was when a rat in the prow fell overboard with a gurgle, his throat pierced by a sharpened, dried bulrush stem. Then the water came alive with reptiles swimming toward the logboat, while others hurled rush lances from the reeded shallows. Mokun crouched low and shouted frantic orders to his crew. Use your paddles! Don't let them aboard or we're lost! The logboat rocked from side to side as Mokun made his way to the prow, pushing past the paddlers. He seized the slain rat's oar and began wielding it energetically, making toward the twin tongues of land that formed the water meadow entrance. Smashing a toad over the head with his blade, the marl fox urged his water rats onward as they alternately paddled or hit out at the reptiles, who attempted to board the logboat. In the stern of the vessel, Fenno gnawed on the thong like a beast in a trap. Slobbering and spitting, he chewed madly, straining the thong tight by pulling hard with his long neck. The rawhide snapped as they were passing through the jutting landspurs. Fenno bundled himself ashore and lay still among the reeds and bushes, watching the cold-eyed reptiles hurrying by, trying to catch the vessel before it struck open water. Mokun felt the pull of the current. Knocking water rats aside, he dashed to the stern of the boat. Paddle for your lives! Keep to the center stream! Go, go! Slashing left and right with his axe, the marl fox slew a toad and a frilled newt, who were clinging to the after end. Powered by panic-stricken rats, the logboat shot off downriver. It was long after midnight when Fenno risked moving a limb. Shutting his ears to the horrible screams of a water rat, whom the reptiles had captured, he crawled off stealthily through the undergrowth. Mokun forced his remaining 9 rats to paddle all night. They halted at dawn on the bank of a dry, sunburned field, but before he allowed them to eat, drink, or tend their wounds, the marl fox had them spread the precious tapestry out on the grass. Clean it, brush the edges well, and make sure the fringe isn't tangled. It must be kept in perfect condition for High Queen Sylph. It is a thing of rare beauty. Mokun posted 2 guards, then, choosing a shady spot, he spread his cloak and lay down to rest, thinking of Fenno and the fate he would suffer in the hold of the merciless reptiles. Mokun felt slightly cheated. He had planned on killing Fenno himself. Raventail surprised even himself. When he and his cohorts went out scouring the countryside to the north and east, they recruited nearly 100 assorted vermin. Naturally, the marl foxes had promised Raventail anything his avaricious heart desired. Armaments, food, power, even the rule of a conquered redwall. Vannon had assured the barbarian ferret that marl foxes had no need of the abbey, because their home was in another place. She explained that the reason Redwall had to fall was because their creatures had murdered 2 of her kin. Raventail figured that there would be a catch to the agreement somewhere, but his overpowering greed got the better of him. Besides, he reasoned, with 100 at his command, he could always turn the tables on his strange allies. Raventail was not a stupid beast. He took note of the fact that Vannon had made a serious mistake in her talks with him. She had admitted that marl foxes could be slain. Vannon, Askrod, and Predak sat surrounded by their water rat soldiers, watching the vermin horde dancing and chanting around a blazing log. Evening shadows, combined with the eerie flicker of flames, cast a wild and primitive air on the proceedings. Weasels, stoats, and ferrets leapt and stamped, pounding the earth until a dust cloud rose around them, flinging their weapons high in the air and catching them expertly as they wailed their killing chants. "Who be death? We be death. Here's de blade what stop your breath. Kayar Rakachaka, wum wum wum. Plunder good, slayin' good. These de blades what shed your blood. Kayar Rakachaka, wum wum wum." Over and over they repeated the chant, getting faster and louder as the tempo of their frenzied dance increased. There was a contemptuous, if slightly nervous, edge to Asgard's tone as he viewed the primeval proceedings. "Stupid savages! What do they think they're doing?" The flames reflected in Vanan's pale, immobile eyes. "Working themselves into a blood frenzy, of course, brother. Here comes Raventail. Don't refer to them as stupid savages while he's around. Greetings, Chief Raventail. You have done well, my friend. These are true warriors you have brought us." The ferret cast a swift sidelong glance at Askrod, as if he had heard the Marrowfox's insulting remark. Twirling his scimitar deftly, he thwacked it into the ground a mere whisker away from Askrod's paw. The Marrowfox twitched. Raventail's red and black daubed face leered at him momentarily. Then he turned away to address Vanan. "Kayar, Magic Fox. These beasts ready for war fight. Much slay, much kill. Better soon we go fight now. Fight now." Greedak and Askrod looked to Vanan. "Now?" The vixen stood, drawing her axe. "Well, they won't get it done chanting and dancing here. What better time than now? 'Twill be full dark when we reach the abbey. Our scouts report that they have been celebrating a victory. This is the time they'll least expect us."
25. Abbey bells boomed softly on the still warm air over Redwall. Grandma Elayo, in company with Sister Slowey, halted their evening stroll by the northeast wall corner. Jangler turned from the battlements, a half-smile in his lazy eyes.
"Now then, old mother, don't you go breaking into a gallop down there. Supper'll be about ready time you get to Cavern Hall."
Elayo shook her stick at her impudent offspring.
"If in my rheumatiz would let me climb yon wall steps, I'd tan your tail for you, Jangler Baybelly."
Skipper winked at Russful. He admired the feisty old squirrel.
"Ha-ha! That'd be a sight to see, mate. Stop there, marm, and I'll come down and lend you a paw. A spot of tannin wouldn't go amiss on this son of yours."
Elayo shook her head, smiling up at the otter chieftain.
"Aren't you three coming inside for supper? Me and Sister Slowey baked a great blackberry jam roly-poly pudding this afternoon."
Russful Raguba gnawed his lip regretfully.
"With pear and honey sauce, too, I'll wager. Trouble is, by the time we got down there, marm, old Florian Forkbottom would have scoffed the lot."
Sister Slowey, normally quite a sedate old mouse, broke out into hoots of laughter.
"Hoo, hoo, hoo! Florian Forkbottom! That's a good un! Hoo, hoo, hoo!"
Elayo turned slowly in the direction of the abbey, lecturing her with mock severity.
"Now, now, sister, that's not very nice. Don't you dare call that poor hair Florian Forkbottom.
Leastways, not afore I do. Hee-hee."
"Don't forget us three hungry beasts up here, ladies,"
Jangler called after the retreating figures.
"See if you can get supper sent out to us, please."
Elayo waved her stick in acknowledgement. Skipper turned back to the wall, leaning his chin on it.
"Hm. It don't look like there's much doing out there tonight, mates. Quiet as a butterfly's bedroom, 'tis."
Russful tested his javelin point lightly.
"Makes me nervous when it's this quiet. What do you say, Jang?"
"You could be right, messmate. I don't like it myself. Too silent."
Skipper was not a creature who favored inactivity. Pacing restlessly up and down the ramparts, he checked his sling and javelin. Jangler and Russful were older than the otter, more used to biding their time throughout the long hours of sentry duty. Russful watched Skipper testing the longbow strings and counting the arrows for the second time that night.
"Skip, will you stop hopping about like you got a thistle under your jerkin?"
"What's up, matey?"
The big otter eyed Mossflower's vast thickness. Not even a leaf was stirring on the still air.
"There's something brewing out there, Russ. The whiskers are starting to twitch, and that's a bad sign.
My old whiskers ain't ever let me down yet."
Jangler's hooded eyes stayed intent on a new sling he was braiding.
"I know the feeling, mate. What are you going to do about it?"
A quiet little look around out there wouldn't go amiss. Stretching the sling against his footpaw, Jangler nodded. So be it, if and that's what you want. We'll let you out by the east wall gate and keep our eyes skinned for you coming back. As the small door closed behind him, the otter chieftain slid off among the trees, armed with only his sling and stone pouch. He threaded his way southeast, using all his natural ability as a hunter, silent and capable. Troglo Spearback and Florian found themselves on dormitory duty. Troglo was used to unruly Dibbons, but the hare was losing patience with the wide-awake Abbey babes. Stiffening both ears and squinching his eyes menacingly, he adopted his no-nonsense voice. Listen here, you confounded curmudgeons. Get to sleep immediately. One more flippin' squeak out of you, and I'll do a spot of tail scalpin', what?
Her, what be ye spotter tail scalpin', sir?
Never you jolly well mind, you young rip. Just get to sleep.
Will ye scalper my tail too, Mr. Florian?
Indeed I will, Master Dwapple. Double sharp, if you don't pipe down.
Do you scalper tails too, Mr. Trago?
Ho, ho, I'm known for it, young'un. Worstest tail scalper in Redwall, that's me. Now get back into bed with you. Immediately all the Dibbons deserted their beds and clamored around the two bewildered dormitory helpers, pleading with them to scalp their tails. It all sounded like great fun to them. Florian and Troglo were completely overwhelmed, being new to dormitory duty, and the hare threw up his paws in resignation. It's all too bally much. How are we supposed to cope with this savage mob of infants, what? Just leave 'em to me, sir. I invented scalpin' naughty tails. At the sound of Craig of Badgermum's booming voice, the Dibbons hurled themselves into the little beds and pulled the blankets over their heads. Craig strode into the dormitory. Right, let's get started. Any particular one you'd like me to scalp, Mr. Florian? The hare shrugged carelessly. Not really, ma'am. Mayhaps you could just dish out a good general scalpin' all round, what? Craig's huge paws felt their way around each bed as she recited, I'll scalp their tails, I'll scalp their ears, then scalp some whiskers, too. No beast scalps like Craig does, and I've scalped quite a few. I love to see 'em turnin' pale. Some'll weep, or some'll wail. Some'll grow up with no tail, when I'm done scalpin' here. So hush, my naughty dear, go fast asleep till morn. That's if you wish to waken up, with tail unscalped by dawn. One more word, just one more peep. Woe betide those not asleep. They will call out, Mercy, help, when the badger starts to scalp.
Silence reigned in the dormitory, apart from one or two false snores from those trying to prove they were really asleep. Tip-pawing out, Craig had closed the door. Florian gulped visibly.
I say, marm, that did the trick, what?
I think a marl fox would take a swift snooze rather than be scalped by you.
Craig smiled as she felt her way downstairs.
Bless their little hearts. The only beast I'd scalp would be one who tried to put a paw near my Dibbons. 'Tis the sound of my big voice puts them in their place, that's all.
So your roar's worse than your scalp, what?
Jolly good idea.
Craig bared her teeth and growled menacingly. But only to Dibbons. I come down extra hard on braggarts and salad fork wreckers. Florian Dugglewolf Wolfachop nipped smartly behind Troglo, placing the hedgehog between the badger and himself.
Indeed, quite right, too, marm. Can't stand those types myself.
At the bottom of the spiral stairwell, they met Bargle. The shrew was scratching his head.
Did a mouse pass by you on his way upstairs?
Troglo shook his head.
Which mouse? What was he like?
Well-built, strong-looking feller. Can't say where I've seen him before, but he looked familiar-like. Wearing armor and carrying a sword, too. Fine weapon.
Bargle found his paw enveloped by Craig's huge mitt.
What did he say? Did he do anything? Speak?
No, not really, marm. He smiled at me and sort of nodded, as if he wanted me to follow him.
Went up these stairs.
Craig pushed the shrew in front of her.
Right, up you go. Let's see where your footpaws take you, Bargle. That could only have been the spirit of Martin the Warrior.
On the floor above the dormitories, Bargle halted, glancing down the passage.
There he is, by that window. Hi there, matey.
He dashed off down the passage.
Can you see him?
Craig muttered to her friends.
The stolid Troglo shrugged slowly. I don't see nothing, marm. Ain't no beast there.
Florian started after Bargle.
Chap must be puddled, what? Scoffed too much supper, I think.
Gregor could not help remarking.
Huh, if that were the case, you'd be seeing visions day and night.
The window was merely a long, narrow, unglazed slit in the wall. Bargle stood by it, rubbing his eyes and blinking.
I'd have took me oath he was here a moment ago, and now he's gone.
Troglo stepped up to the window.
Well, 'tis clear that Martin wanted us to look out of this window. Why else should he lead us up here?
It needed but a single glance through the window to see what Martin had wanted to warn them about. Torches and firebrands were advancing on the abbey from the east, over 200 of them.
Bargle felt himself pushed toward the stairs by Florian. No need to panic, old chap. Just because the foe beast is back, what? Dash on down and get some beast up to the Bally Bell Tower. Sound the flippant alarm. Stand by to repel invaders. Turn out the blinkin' troops. What else? Oh, tell him to pack me some tucker, to keep me going up on those walls, what? Nothing elaborate. Bowl of salad, basin of trifle,
Craig's mighty paw stifled further babble from the excited hare.
Hearken, go downstairs quietly. Don't rush. Gather every able-bodied Redwaller and report to Skipper and his friends on the walltop. They'll know what to do. Above all, don't toll the bells. The vermin will know we've seen them, if they hear an alarm. Go swift and silent now.
Askrod laughed aloud with exhilaration as the whir of blazing torches carried by charging vermin swept by him. Waving his own firebrand at Vannon, he called out,
Tonight's the night we take Redwall, I know it.
Pale eyes glittering in the torch flames, the vixen licked at her axe blade, as if she were already tasting blood.
Luck is with us. I feel it in my bones, brother.
One of Raventail's ferrets says he just slew an otter, a big male, probably a Redwall scout.
Raventail was leading the front runners. His keen eyes glimpsed the unmistakable bulk of the abbey ramparts looming up in the darkness. Waving his scimitar, the barbarian ferret gave vent to an eerie howl, which was taken up by his followers.
Killslay! Kayar!
Fearsome-looking vermin, their faces painted heavily for war, leapt forward. Thrusting their torches on the ground, they whirled grappling hooks on ropes and hurled them up at the battlements. Torches clenched in their fangs, the first wave began hauling themselves up the ropes to the parapet. The three Marl foxes marshaled their archers in position, Predak herself taking a bow and calling orders.
Shoot anything that moves on the wall tops. Cover those climbing the ropes.
Jangler stepped back as another grapnel flew over the battlements and latched in a niche. All along the east wall, the three-pronged metal barbs were clanking and grating as they bit into mortared sandstone cracks. The squirrel warrior's hooded eyes watched them carefully. When he judged the time was right, he signaled Rustful and Bargle.
They're all in place. Tell Melilot and the others they can bring it up now, mates.
Assisted by Rimrose, Alayo, Slowey, and all the kitchen helpers, Brother Melilot ascended the wall stairs. Each of them carried pan, pail, bowl, or any other variety of large container they could lay paws upon. They came up the steps slowly, so as not to spill the contents of their vessels. Rustful Raguba took a bucket from Sister Slowey's trembling paws, nodding politely.
Well done, ma'am. Now stand back down those stairs. You've done your bit. Leave the rest to us.
All along the wall, Gwasom shrews were taking the vessels from the kitchen helpers and setting them on the battlements anywhere a grapnel was fixed. Jangler took a swift peek over the wall top, moving immediately behind a battlement as a volley of arrows whizzed by. He nodded at Bargle and Rustful.
Their archers have the walls well marked. We'd best do it smart-like. There's all manner of scum coming up these ropes.
Rustful steadied a large cooking pot with one paw. All carrion lighted torches, I hope. Jangler winked at his warrior friend.
Aye, matey. Pretty as a twinkling nest of fireflies. Let's give it to him. One, two, three, now!
On Jangler's signal, a blend of heated cooking oil, vegetable oil, used as lantern fuel, and any kind of waste oil or grease from kitchen or repair shop was heaved over the top. The outside of the entire east wall lit up with a tremendous whoosh as the hot oil met the battery of blazing torches. Both vermin and ropes went up in a crackling sheet of flame. Jangler sat beside Rustful and Bargle in the shelter of the ramparts, eyes streaming from the thick coils of black smoke wreathing about them.
The squirrel warrior shook his head regretfully, raising his voice above the agonized shrieks of the vermin. "'Tis a terrible thing to happen to any beast, mates. Terrible." Florian came scuttling up to join them, bringing a jug of cold mint tea, which they passed from one to the other. The hare wiped his mouth with the back of a paw.
Dreadful, I agree. But the blighters brought it upon themselves. I say, move over, you chaps. The vermin'll have something else on their belly mind soon. Here comes Formole with his stalwarts to chuck stones on 'em. Ha! Looks like my noon veilers have joined them. What ho, runk old lad? You taking to being a mole now?
Rup and Muggle stifled giggles at the thought. Hur, 'twould take some doing to be a spoiky mole, sir. Runktip helped the moles to lug large baskets of rock and masonry chunks over to the battlements. He winked at Florian.
I'm as good a mole as the next un. We all are. Ain't that right, Boracle?
The otter nodded stolidly as he hefted a basket.
Aye, we certainly are, matey. And moles get better fed than performers, I can tell you.
Florian snorted.
Cheeky bounder. Go on, then. Be moles, all of you. See if I jolly well care.
Runktip put on his best mole accent.
Grr, Formole, sir, do us'ns be about ready now?
Formole waved a digging claw to his crew and the noon veilers.
Hur, moy arties, chuck em o'er good and hard now.
On Formole's command, the joint crew of moles and performers grabbed the baskets and slung them forcefully over the parapet, scattering the contents on the attackers below. Remrose and others brought cool, damp towels up to the defenders, who wiped their eyes and bathed their faces gratefully. Remrose clasped Jangler's paw.
Some beast told me that Skipper's out there. Oh, dear, I do hope he's all right. Do you think they've captured him?
Jangler chided his wife gently.
There you go again, worry, worry, all the time. First is Song and her friends, now it's Skipper's turn. I tell you, Beauty, that old river dog's safe as a nut in its shell. He'd have a good laugh if and he could see you now, frettin' and fussin' o'er him. Skipper can take care of hisself better than I can, believe me.
Remrose bathed Jangler's heavy-lidded eyes carefully.
Well, if you say so, I suppose Skipper's safe. I'm thankful that Song and those two other young'uns are well out of this.
The squirrel warrior squeezed his wife's paw lightly.
Those three? I'll wager they're somewheres snug along a riverbank, feeding their faces and singing round a campfire.
Remrose smiled and nodded.
Aye, and our Song's the one who'll be doing the singing. Oh, Mr. Florian, let me bathe your eyes for you. They look sore.
Florian adopted his brave face, though his eyes were indeed streaming from the oily smoke.
Most kind of you, ma'am. Confounded little smudge in the corner of my left lamp here. Perhaps you can get it. Nothing like the thistle-down touch of a pretty squirrel, what?
Mahon came from the south wall and reported everything quiet. Friar Butty, who had been watching the west wall, said the same. Jangler looked over to the north wall where the gossam shrew Splicker was stationed.
What's wrong with old Splicker? Looks like he's listening hard over there. Go and see if anything's amiss, Margle.
The shrew slid off, crouching low. After a brief conversation with his comrade, he came hurrying back.
Splicker reckons there's a steady noise over that way, coming from nearby. Sounds like they're chopping at something.
Jangler and Russell went to the north wall to investigate. They crouched low alongside Splicker, listening to the steady ring of axe against timber. A leaf landed on Jangler's head. The squirrel studied it, then popped up to chance a quick scan of the woodland. He sat back down again, gnawing worriedly at his lip. Russell looked at him.
Something's wrong, mate. What are they up to?
Jangler passed him the leaf.
Oak. They're chopping away at an old giant three-topped oak. If it falls, the wall could be breached. And then we'd have our paws full trying to stop 'em coming in. We'll need to get our thinking caps on, Russ. They could maybe fell a tree that size by tomorrow morning, or midday.
Somewhere in the depths of Mossflower Wood, Skipper gritted his teeth as he sat on a stream bank, tugging a broken spear from his leg. As he pulled, the otter chieftain was giving himself a good telling off.
Unch! Puddle-headed old river-go. That's what you are, matey. Fancy a great big lump like yourself getting caught off guard by a lousy painted varmint. Ooh! Easy now, messmate. Out she comes. Ah! There now.
Spirit Spear ain't made that could lay a decent otter low. That'll teach yer to jump quicker next time, and keep your eyes peeled, too. He sorted through the plants he had garnered from nearby. Dock leaves. Sanicle and young burdock. That should do. Crushing them together with pawfuls of bank mud, he applied the cooling poultice to his injured limb and bound the lot with a strip from his jerkin. Little sister Slowey'd have a fit if she saw this sloppy job, but it'll have to do for now. Right. Set sail, matey. In we go. He slid awkwardly into the stream. Once in the water, however, the otter swam slowly and gracefully away into the night, going in the opposite direction to Redwall Abbey. Only two creatures at a time could chop at the great oak. At first, Vannon had set four to the task, but they got in each other's way until two suffered axe cuts. Raventail snorted impatiently at the Marl Fox. "Kyre, arr! You say big tree be half dead. No take long. Ya kacha!" Vannon regarded the barbarian ferret disdainfully. "The tree is half dead. 'Twill fall sooner or later. Patience seems to me a much better idea than charging in like your lot did, screaming and yelling, with lighted torches to advertise your presence. What kind of stealth attack is that? They were ready for us long before we arrived at the wall." Raventail took a pace back, executing a scornful bow. "Whoa! Big magic fox be cleverer much. 'Scusey me." Vannon ignored the jibe, signaling to two water rats. "You and you. Take over chopping. I'll make it work this time." As the water rats stepped in to take over from the two ferrets, currently wielding the axes, a big arrow from a longbow felled one of the vermin. On the wall top, Jangler fitted another shaft to his powerful weapon. "Ain't much to aim at, Russ, but 'tis all we can do to stop 'em." Russ Foldraguba sighted down the arrow on his bow, then let the string slack with a sigh. "Cha! They could hide behind that oak and chop away all season. Not much we can do about it, mate. The tree is going to fall sooner or later, for sure." Act 3. The Queen's Island. 26. As the pounding rush of waters enveloped Song, she struck out wildly. Her world now consisted of a roaring, boiling melee, in which she was as helpless as a leaf in a hurricane. Water battered her eyes shut, gushing up her nostrils, down her ears and into her mouth. Without warning, a powerful pair of talons latched onto her paws, like a drowning swimmer clutching a twig. Something hard struck her body, a jagged peak of rock sticking up underwater. Heavy, sodden feathers flapped slowly, embracing her. The squirrel maid forced her eyes open for an instant and found herself facing a huge, hooked amber beak. Then an eddy caught both Song and the osprey, whirling them around the rocky pinnacle like a pair of spinning tops. There was tension pulling at Song from the rope tied about her waist, but then it slackened off with frightening suddenness. The side of Song's head thudded against the rock, knocking her senseless. On the rocky edge of the waterfall, Dan felt the rope go slack. Numbly, he drew in the line, stunned by what had happened. Behind him, he could hear Dippler yelling hoarsely, "Song, where are you? Song!" Dan sat down with a groan, covering his eyes with both paws, trying to blot out the awful realization of tragedy. Dippler slapped him hard across the face, shouting at him over the roaring noise of falling waters. "Get up, mate! Keep an eye on the place where she went down. I'm going to get Burble on the boat. Wait here." Galvanized into action, Dan sprang upright. He found a broken branch and tied it to the rope's end. As Dippler raced away, he saw Dan throwing the branch out into the water cascade, roaring, "Grab the branch if you're there, Song! Grab the branch!" Dippler clambered off over the wet stones, muttering aloud, "Leastways he's doing something instead of sitting there in a blinking trance." Song twisted and turned. Grandma Olayo was standing right in front of her, talking, but her voice sounded strange. Rimrose and Jangler had tight hold of Song's paws, and Olayo was speaking to them. "Rrr! Should have threw dem back in. Not fishes, rrr, no. Only trouble. Gluck, gluck." Now Olayo was forcing Rimrose and Jangler to release their grip on Song, though her parents' paws felt unusually sharp and strong. Olayo was speaking again. "Rrr! Use your beak, dumb duck. Use your beak. Rrr!" The squirrel maid's eyes opened slowly.
She could not focus properly and seemed to be viewing things through a haze. Small snake-like creatures with long, narrow beaks surrounded her head. One pecked Song sharply on her nose tip. Song sat up, shaking her head, sending the creatures scattering. When her vision cleared, a big bird to one side of her was cackling, "Gluck, gluck, gluck. Can't eat 'em, not fishes. Gluck, gluck." The small creatures were not snakes. They were long-necked cormorant chicks. Her paws were freed by a full-grown male, obviously the father.
"Rrr, we catch fishes, gluck, gluck. You catch big eagle."
The mother cormorant, whom Song had taken to be a layo, chanced to peck at the offspring. It did not stir.
"Gluck, gluck. This bird deader'n dead fish, methinks."
The male cormorant's strange blue eyes blinked scornfully.
"Reek. Eagle alive as me and you. Wait and see."
Song lay recovering her senses as the two cormorants began an argument, hopping about and fanning out their wings, while the chicks scurried this way and that to avoid being danced on or batted by an outstretched wing.
"Rah! Eagle alive? Squiddle too. Rrr!
Not in my nest, thanky. Gluck! They'll eat my egg chicks. Gear 'em out. Gluck, gluck. Don't be a dat duck. Eagle and squiddle won't eat egg chicks. I saved their lives. Rrr! Rrr, gluck! Such a beak. Saved their lives. Wreck! I say gear 'em out. Not staying in my nest. Squiddles, eagles, chuck. Not stopping here."
While the furious debate raged on, the little chicks never let up their ceaseless cries.
Glick, 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 glick.
Song took stock of her position. She was at the center of a large, untidy twig-and-grass nest, sprawled atop a rock shelf, somewhere downstream. To her left, she could vaguely see the falls and hear their distant roar. On other parts of the ledge were similar nests, all occupied by cormorant families. At odd moments, one of the birds would plunge off the ledge into the broad, deep stream, disappearing underwater for quite a while, then suddenly bobbing up a good distance away, usually holding a wriggling fish in its beak. Beside her, the osprey opened one flecked golden eye. Immediately all activity ceased, the cormorants frozen in fear. The big fish eagle's dangerous beak opened wide. Song held her breath. It was a frightening sight, but then the osprey retched, spewing forth a fountain of water. Shaking its body vigorously, the big bird struggled into a standing position. Both the fierce eyes were open now, and Song quailed under their savage scrutiny. A heavily taloned claw placed itself lightly on her paw.
"You're a bonny beast, lassie. You saved the life of McGraw, and I'll no forget it. What name do you go by?"
Song shook the taloned claw warmly.
"I'm called Songbreeze, sir, but you may call me Song."
Something resembling a smile hovered on the eagle's fierce face.
"Ach, don't be calling me Sir Song, my lass. I'm known by the name of Mighty McGraw, but McGraw'll do just fine."
Then the eagle turned to the male cormorant, nodding politely.
"And my thanks to ye, good bird, for pulling us frae yon water."
The female cormorant averted her head, speaking as if to no beast in particular, as she hugged and plumped her feathers.
"Rrr, squiddles and eagles can't stop here. Gluck, gluck, no."
McGraw fixed her with a murderous stare.
"Do you no say? Well, my compliments to you, marm. Me and my good friend'll no stay longer than the time it takes us to walk away from here. Though, if you look doon your beak at us like that again, I'll eat you for sure and give your mate a bit of peace. Good day to you now. Come on, Song, my wee lassie."
Song followed McGraw as he limped from the nest, nodding a silent and grateful farewell to the male cormorant as she went. Making their way along the bank, they left the rocky area and sat to rest on a mossy sward. Night was beginning to fall. McGraw nodded his head in both directions.
"Well, which way new, Song?"
The squirrel maid looked back toward the waterfall.
"I have three friends, but I parted from them at the top of the falls when I jumped in after you. They'll be searching for me now, I expect. Perhaps we'd best stay here until they come along this way to find me. What do you think, McGraw?"
"Aye, we'll do that. Though I'm powerful hungry the new."
Song undid the broken rope from about her waist, surprised that her leafwood stick was still thrust into it.
"You stay there and rest, Mr. McGraw. I'll go and find us some fruit and berries. Should be some hereabouts."
The osprey squinched his eyes up in disgust.
Fruit and berries, did you say? You'll poison yourself for sure, lass. You go and search out your own victuals, and leave me here to fish. And don't call me mister. The name's McGraw, deacon.
Song had not strayed far when she found blackberries and some fine apples. As she returned to the bank, McGraw averted his head politely and swallowed.
A good spot, this. I got myself a plump wee grayling. But fear not, Song, 'tis gone now. I mind how the sight of flesh-eaters can upset those who live on roots and berries and such nonsense. They wonder they cannot fly.
As night drew on, the strange pair sat by the stream, telling each other their life stories. When Song had told McGraw about the quest she and her friends were on, he perked up immediately. It turned out that the osprey was a wanderer, a lone, wide-ranging eagle. He had come down from the far northeast. In his travels, he had discovered a big inland lake, where the fish were plentiful. All pike, but that made little difference to him. He was very partial to a big pike. But one night, when McGraw was resting in a partially constructed nest he was building on the lake shore, he was ambushed by a mob of magpies. The birds took him completely by surprise and thrashed him. The osprey managed to escape with three things: his life, a broken wing, and a massively injured pride. He had traveled far from the lake, finally settling on the falls as a place where other creatures could not bother him. McGraw stared at the stream, his wild eyes glittering with the light of vengeance.
I swear on my mother's egg, I'll find that lake again. Aye, some day I'll gang back there and meet with young magpies to settle my score with them. Mark my words, Song. They'll wish they'd ne'er been hatched when the wrath of mighty McGraw descends on them. Ach, but what can a bird do with a broke wing? Can you tell me that, Song?
The squirrel maid stroked McGraw's wing, which flopped uselessly at his side. She had come to like the big osprey immensely in the short time she had known him. He was fierce but well-mannered, a true warrior. Also, she loved the way he pronounced her name as Song.
Well, you could come with me and my friends when we get together. We're searching for the lake, too, you know. How would you like that, McGraw?
The osprey blew out his chest to alarming proportions and winked slyly at his new friend.
I'd like that fine, lass.
Burble, Dippler, and Dan did not rest that night. Each of them was convinced that Song was dead. Just one look at the mighty waterfall was enough. No beast could go over its edge and live, but none would admit it, so they kept up brave faces, reassuring each other. Now that Dan had snapped out of his despairing mood, he was acting like a confident leader.
Right. You know what Mr. Florian would say? There's only one bally thing for it, chaps.
What?
We'll scale down the cliffside, lower the jolly old boat on what's left of our rope, and get to the bottom sharpish.
Though Burble and Dippler felt as if leaden weights had been implanted in their chests at the loss of Song, they agreed with a great show of false optimism.
Yes, yes, and I'll wager the first old creature we find down there'll be the bold Song, eh?
Ha-ha, right. And she'll say, "What took you lot so long? You should have come down the quick way like I did."
It was the worst night of their lives, climbing down a spray-drenched cliff face, with the waterfall pounding along on their left side. Dan found that the broken length of rope proved invaluable. He would lower himself down, then have the swallow lured to him before guiding the other two safely on their descent. No easy task by night, even though the rocks on that side were not smooth. But with great good fortune, lots of rests on ledges and good cooperation between them, combined with Dan's great climbing skills, they had covered halfway by dawn. Stopping on a small crag, they made a scratch breakfast. Dippler peered down. He could see the pool below the falls through the misty spray.
I'd say we could make it by midday if things go all right.
Yes, yes, midday, or even just before. We'd best save some victuals. Miss Song will be about ready for lunch when we arrive.
Dan sighed heavily, but managed to force a smile.
Come on, you two. Let's get going instead of guzzling.
About mid-morning, Song confided her thoughts to McGraw on the stream bank.
Suppose they went right by us during the night. We didn't have anything to make a signal fire with, and my friends could quite easily have rowed past in our boat, not knowing we're here.
McGraw flapped the useless wing at his side.
Aye, you could be right, Song. What do you suggest?
The squirrel maid stood up, pointing downstream.
I think we'd do well walking slowly along the bank in clear sight.
I'll bet they find us before the day's through.
The osprey rose and walked along with her.
Ach, anything's better than squatting in one place, or sitting in yon fussy old cormorant bird's nesty. Did you hear her?
McGraw could not help chuckling as Song imitated the cormorant.
Rrr, squiddles and eagles not stay in my nest, Glock, no. They not fishes, Gluck, Gluck, eat up my egg chicks. Rrr.
Haw, haw, haw. Did you mind the look on yon laddie's beak when I threatened to eat his wife? He looked fair happy, so he did. Mokin could see the lake in the distance. The Marrow Fox stood on a hilly rise where the river flowed downward toward the huge body of water. He watched the wild rapids plunging down to the lake, thinking. Now he had come this far, there was no point in having the logboat wrecked with himself and the tapestry aboard. He chose two of his remaining water rats. You and you, get in the boat and take it down to the lake. The rest of you, pick up that tapestry. Be careful with it. We'll walk along the bank and meet the boat at the lake's edge. Stolidly obedient, one of the two rats got into the logboat and picked up a paddle. However, his companion took one look at the pounding, rock-strewn rapids and stayed where he was, safe on shore. Mokin patted him on the back reassuringly. What's the matter? Afraid of a little rough ride? The water rat's eyes were wide with fear as he nodded dumbly. Mokin shrugged, smiling at the rodent. You don't have to go if you don't want to. Stay here. The Marrow Fox's axe flashed in the sunlight as he slew the unfortunate beast with a single hard blow. Still smiling, he pointed to another water rat. Would you like to stay here with him? The rat leapt into the logboat and seized a paddle.
No, sire. I'll take the boat down to the lake.
Mokin stowed the axe back in his belt.
Good. We'll meet you by the shore.
Dan and his friends reached the bottom of the falls at precisely midday. They searched the area as best they could until nigh on late noon. Dippler and Burble came back from their reconnaissance to find the young squirrel seated despondently on the ground, shaking his head.
There's not a sign of Song or that osprey. Not a feather, a scrap of rope, nothing.
Ever the optimist, Burble nodded in agreement.
Yes, yes, that only means one thing, Dan me bucko. Song's alive and safe somewheres. Yes, yes, you know what they say. No news is good news.
Dippler flung out a paw in the direction of the water.
Then which way do you think she's gone?
Dan was suddenly struck with an idea.
The swallow should tell us. Let's get away from this area to where the water's smoother.
Then we'll launch her and see which way she carries us. The current goes the same way for anything on the water, right?
Yes, yes. Good old Dan, you're right, mate.
Finding a good spot, they launched the boat and sat in it, leaving their paddles shipped so that the water could carry them along. When they were out in the main stream of the wide swirling pool beneath the waterfall, Dan pointed off to his right.
Look, there's a broad stream running off that way. Maybe that's the way Song went.
Dippler watched the prow of the swallow nosing along in the water.
Maybe, but it ain't the way we're bound, pals. Look dead ahead.
There was another high cliff in front of them. The water was running straight into a cave beneath the cliffs opposite the falls. The swallow picked up speed, and they braced themselves. The current was sucking them toward the dark hole. Had they launched the swallow on the other side of the pool, they would have run into the stream, but the realization came too late.
Dan grabbed his paddle, shouting, Backwater! Try to turn her, or we'll go right into that hole!
But they could not fight the inevitable. Hard as they tried, the little boat was sucked into the dark, gaping hole, despite their heroic efforts with the paddles. One moment they were sweating and striving in the bright sunlight. Next instant they were swept into the black chasm and into another waterfall, which plunged straight down underground. 27. Troglo's Spearback and Friar Buddy were in the kitchens making oatmeal scones for breakfast. Troglo pulled trays of the hot scones from the ovens and laid them out in neat rows. Old Friar Buddy followed him up, making a sloping slice into the top of each scone, until the whole batch was ready. Then Troglo took an earthenware jar and a wooden spoon, and starting at the first tray, he began filling the slice in each scone with a gob of thick, fawn-colored honey. Friar Buddy followed, placing a thin slice of crystallized plum in the honey. They worked dutifully and well, until Florian Dugglewolf Wolfachop sauntered into the kitchens, sniffing the air appreciatively.
I say, you chaps, something smells jolly good, what?
Troglo menaced the gluttonous hare with his honey spoon.
Them's for breakfast, Mr. Florian. you put a paw near our scones, and I'll raise a lump on it with this here spoon."
Florian managed a look of outraged innocence.
"Steady on, old lad. I'm no blinkin' scone robber. I merely popped in, so to speak, to see if you needed any assistance. No need to accuse a chap of felonious intentions on your scones."
Friar Butty continued his work, keeping one eye upon the hare.
"Well, we don't need any assistance, so to speak, thank you. I thought you were supposed to be up on the wall tops, defending us from vermin attack. What are you doing down here?"
Florian continued to sniff the aroma of fresh-baked scones, striding up and down the kitchens with an air of exaggerated boredom, getting closer to the cooling trays all the time.
"Doing down here? Me? Oh, this and that, you know. Gets rather tedious standing on a flippin' wall-top all night, watching those vermin types chopping away at a tree. Jolly boring, what?"
Buddy looked up from his work.
"Which tree? What's going on up there?"
Florian pulled a wry face at the stout Troglo, who had placed himself in front of the scones.
"Over by the north wall. Great old three-topped oak. Half-dead, but amazingly thick. Those bally villains are hacking away at it with axes. They want to fell it so that it'll fall against the wall and provide a road into the abbey for them. Fiddly-dee. It'll take them all season to chop that monster down. I say, what are you chaps smiling at? Nothing to be happy about, really. If that tree falls, you'll have a mob of vermin in here pinching your breakfast scones, what?"
Troglo put down his honey jar and spoon.
"Big, half-dead, old three-topped oak at the north wall, do you say?"
"Rather.
Great blinkin' hunk of a thing. Must be nigh on a squillion seasons old."
Friar Butty relinquished the crystallized fruit. Still smiling broadly, he wiped both paws on his apron.
"Tell me, how long have they been chopping at the old oak?"
"Oh, not too long, really. Couldn't say for sure. Why?" Troglo was making for the door, a huge grin on his face.
"Come on, Buddy, we got to see this."
The old recorder followed him eagerly. Florian pursued them, snatching two scones from a tray.
"Wait for me, chaps. Ooh, these scones are scorching hot, what?"
Jangler Swifteye paced the ramparts, arrow on bowstring, quivering with frustration.
"Can't see the scum to get a clear shot, Russ."
Rustful Raguba sat down, covering his ears with both paws.
"Chop, chop, chop. The sound of those confounded axes is driving me mad, matey."
Butty, Troglo, and Florian climbed the north wall steps, with Krega, Formole Gubbio, and his mixed crew of moles and moonveilers following behind. Troglo peeped over the battlements and laughed aloud.
"Ho, ho, ho! Any moment now, they be in for a real surprise."
Jangler looked at the cellar hog strangely.
"I don't see nothing funny in all this, mate. Neither'll you if that oak falls atop the wall."
Krega placed a placating paw on the angry squirrel.
"I'm sorry, friend. Let me explain. That old tree is rotted right through its middle due to big stinging termites. If it weren't night, you could see the hive, too, and the fork where the three tops meet. The largest honeybee hive in all Mossflower rests in yonder oak, but we've never been able to get at the honey because of the bees and termites. The bees guard their hive, and the termites guard the tree. As soon as the vermin strike soft wood, they're in big trouble."
Formole Gubbio shook his head.
"Them bumbly bees and termiters be a-takin' ye arter solstice nap. Her, woe to ye who wakes em up, zur, boroy."
Boracle peeped over the wall-top, his curiosity aroused by the news.
"When can we expect something to happen, marm?"
Krega felt about until she found somewhere comfortable to sit.
"As soon as the axes stop that hard chopping noise and hit the soft rotted wood."
As Vannon watched two new axe beasts take the place of two weary ones, Raventail scoffed.
"Kyar, we be old beasts by time Big Tree fall."
The Marl Fox ignored the jibe, listening to the steady ring of axe blades against oak wood.
Chop, chop, chop.
One of the water rats wielding an axe stopped suddenly, wincing as he rubbed curiously at his cheek. Vannon glared at him irately.
"What have you stopped for?"
"Something stung me, marm."
"Idiot, get back to work, or my axe will sting your neck."
Chop, 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 thunk, whoomp.
The Marl Fox's pale eyes shone triumphantly.
"Ah, now we're getting somewhere. Swing those axes harder."
As she spoke, Bannon drew in her breath sharply. Raising her left footpaw, she flattened the big termite that was biting her. At the same instant, her right footpaw was attacked by several more of the angry insects. In no time at all, Bannon was hopping from one paw to the other, swiping at termites. Raventail stepped back, laughing.
Kaya ha ha ha! Big magic fox dancing loco loco!
Both water rats had ceased chopping and were slapping their bodies all over, maddened by the fiery stabs of pain. An ominous buzzing filled the air. Raventail was still laughing as a swarm of bees descended on his head, where they went to work with a vengeance. Now the very air hummed, and the ground was alive. Insects flooded from the tree-topped oak, biting and stinging anything they encountered. The moment they felt the first stings, Askrod and Predak fled the scene, leaving Raventail, Bannon, and the waiting crowd of barbarians and water rats to their tormentors. The would-be invaders screamed and roared, some throwing themselves flat on the ground, unwittingly escaping the bees, only to writhe amid the termites. Others tried to scale trees, driven almost crazy with agony, as bees swarmed all over them. Those who fled were pursued by the bees, and they ran as if they were dancing some insane jig, slapping at the termites that clung doggedly on. Bushes were trampled, low-hanging branches snapped, and the night air rang with screeches and yells. Troglo Spearback began herding every beast down from the wall, cautioning as they went.
Go easy now. Don't hurry. Move slow and stay calm. Those bees ain't flown up this eye yet, but they soon will.
Dawn arrived in pale rose-washed sky, scattered with small cream-hued clouds. Krega Badgermom stood in the abbey doorway with Elayo, listening to the massed chorus of birdsong resounding in the woodlands. Elayo looked over toward the north wall.
Birdies sound happy and joyous this morning, Krega.
Aye, so they do. I hear thrushes, blackbirds, finches, and robins, too. All manner of our feathered friends. Do you know what they're doing, Elayo?
Oh, yes. They're thanking the vermin for giving them such a fine breakfast of bees and termites. Kind of the faux beasts, wasn't it?
Indeed it was, though I don't think they'll be bothered about birdsong right now. Mud poultices and dock leaves will be more their concern this fine morning.
Let that be a lesson to the rogues, I say. None of ours were stung, were they, Krega?
Only one. That was Florian, who had a smear of honey on the tip of his nose. That'll teach him to steal scones.
Hush, here he comes now.
The hare looked a comical sight, with his nose swathed in a poultice of dock leaf, motherwort, and pond mud. He strode toward the pond in search of fresh mud, pursued by several Dibbons and Troglo, who had made up a little ditty about the incident, which he sang with evident gusto.
Ho, there am I, a little bee, a-livin' in my old oak tree, when some bad varmint with an axe deals my ohm a good few whacks. Oh, buzz, says I, now what's amiss? Good gracious me, I can't have this. So buzz, 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 I flies right out, wags my sting and looks about. Buzz, 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 who can I sting? Whoever did this wicked thing. So right up in the air I fly, and there the villain I espy. Buzz, 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 the one I chose had honey smeared all on his nose. Buzz, 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 aye, that's him there, that horrible funny-looking hare. Steal my honey, that ain't fair. You're going to pay the price, proud sir. Buzz, 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 so down I goes, and stings him hard upon his nose. I made him leap and howl and wail, and that's the sting in my small tail. Buzz, 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 I tell you, folk, stay clear of my old three-topped oak.
Elayo chuckled as she described the scene to Krega.
He, he, he. The Dibbons are dancing round Mr. Florian, and whirring their paws as if they was wings. Hear 'em making buzzing noises. I won't repeat to you what that hare's a-saying.
Krega smiled.
You've no need to, friend. I can hear him.
Florian was stumbling over Dibbons, holding the poultice still and shouting at them.
Away, and leave me in peace, you pint-sized rotters. Get from under me paws, vile infants. And you, Troglo, sir, there's nothing funny in a warrior getting his hooter nipped by a confounded buzzing insect. Shame on you and all your ilk, sir. You're a bounder and a pollywoggle, and a dreadful singer to boot. So there, what?
Troglo retaliated by quickly composing the first line of a new ditty.
I'll sing you a ballad of a fork from a salad.
Clapping both paws over his ears, Florian dashed off, yelling,
"Yah, you great overstuffed pincushion! Bad form! Add an insult to injury! Go away and leave me alone, you fatty needle-bottomed cask-thumper.
Russell joined the listeners at the doorway. Poor old Florian. Don't have much luck, does he? Ho, 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 ho. Askrod and Predak were the least hurt of the besieging army. Raventail was unrecognizable, his head completely misshapen by stinging lumps, made uglier with a thick coating of pounded dock and stream mud. Vannon was so full of poison from termite bites that her footpaws had swollen like balloons. Askrod shook his head. Who'd believe it, sister? The injuries that insects can inflict. I took count a while ago. 6 are missing, either stung to death or run away after being driven mad. Predak viewed the scene in grim silence. After a while, she gripped her axe handle resolutely. We're not going to be defeated, brother. This thing has gone too far. There has to be something simple, a thing that every beast has overlooked. Redwall Abbey can be conquered. I know it can. Askrod was impressed by his sister's fervor. I believe you, Predak. But what's the answer? Everything we've tried so far has failed, and 2 Marl foxes are slain. Predak looked about her desperately. Leave these fools to nurse their wounds. Come on, we know that no creature alive can outwit a Marl fox. We're going back to Redwall. We'll lay low and study it carefully from every possible angle. We won't rush into any harebrained scheme. We'll stop and watch and listen. Take note of everything. Until we come up with a simple, foolproof solution. Askrod stared levelly at the vixen. Yes, I believe we will, sister of mine. Remember that rhyme our mother used to recite when we were little more than cubs? The Marl fox cannot be bested, either in cunning or stealth. Whenever there is power to be seized, plunder, land, or wealth, when other minds are slumbering, the Marl fox is wide awake, figuring how and where and when to deceive, to slay, to take. Invisibly, by the magical guile, slyly, with less than a sound, count your paws, make sure they're yours, when the Marl fox is around. Like smoke on summer wind, Askrod and Predak vanished from the camp, into the thicknesses of Mossflower, back toward Redwall Abbey. The mouse-babe Dwapple and his partners in crime, mole-babes Wugger and Blinny, had become Marl foxes again. Daubed with flour and ashes, and wearing gray blanket cloaks, they trundled into the kitchens and loaded a full plum pudding onto a cart. Believing themselves invisible, they hauled the cart away, looking back over their shoulders and giggling. They made it safely out of the kitchens, only to be halted by the javelin of Rustfold Raguba. "Ha-ha! You didn't know that I'm the only beast in Redwall who can spot Marl foxes, did you? Now prepare to be slain!" Dwapple blew a sigh of frustration and seated himself on the cart. Ruskell could not help smiling at the little fellow.
"Pwah! Us all is getting catched, 'cause we not real marm foxes, I oppose. If you don't slain us, we gives you some puddin'."
Ruskell relieved them of the pudding and took it back to the kitchen. He gave them a candied chestnut apiece.
"It ain't nice to steal, you know. If you want victuals, you've only got to ask. For no beast goes hungry at Redwall. Another thing, being Marl foxes isn't good either. You'd do better being Redwall warriors, like Martin on the tapestry."
Wugger seated himself on a pile of flour sacks.
"Your Dan be fetching ye tarpisty back, your zur. Bain't that so? I spec Dan'll be back soon. Do ee, zur?"
The squirrel warrior seated himself beside the mole babe. A tear coursed down his craggy features, and he turned his head aside quickly, hoping the Dibbons had not seen it.
"I 'ope he will, little'un. If any beast brings back the tapestry, it'll be my Dan. He's a Raguba, you know, bravest of the brave."
Dwapple popped a plum out of the pudding and munched it.
"Will Marm Floxes be back, Mr. Rusbull? Mr. Flory say they am all goed, and not come back here no more."
Rusbull stroked the mouse babe's head pensively. "Mr. Florian and lots of others say they won't be back, and certainly no beast in this abbey wants to see that lot return.
But you take my word for it, little feller. There's a world of difference between what we'd like and what we get. No beast knows that better than I. Take it from me, all of you. Those Marl foxes'll be back, and they're vermin with them, I'm certain of it, sure as I'm sitting here talking to you."
The Dibbons shook off their blanket cloaks and began dusting themselves down.
"Come on, Wug. Us gonna be Redwall warriors.
What does Red All Warriors look like, Mr. Rustful?
Rustful looked at the Dibbons standing boldly before him.
Just like you three, mates. Now go on with you. Off and play.
He watched them scampering off, thinking of his own son Dan when he was their age, innocent, fearless, and happy. Then Jangler peered around the kitchen entrance at his friend.
Come on up on the wall, matey. There's something I think you should see.
28. Things happened so fast for Dan and his friends that it was difficult for them to recall the incident later. Clinging to the boat sides, paddles forgotten, they shot into the underground waterfall like an arrow from a bow. The Swallow was such a light craft, she was whipped over the torrent's edge and flung straight into the Stygian gloom. Noise like none had ever known echoed and reverberated around them. Darkness was everywhere. Breathless and battered by heavy spray, the three companions felt their boat spin through the air, down, down, down. There was a sudden impact. The Swallow struck an underground ledge with a rending crunch. All three were flung from the boat, half-stunned, into a whirling, sucking miasma of dark, icy water, far below the earth's surface. Dan felt himself rushed along on a mighty current, bumping into rocks and scraping against slime-covered side channels, being swept always on a downward path. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.